Welcome
to the Love and Respect Podcast,
a conversation that changes the way you view all relationships, whether married, single, parent, or professional. Discover the relationship secret hidden in plain sight. And now the intersection of theology and psychology. Conversations between pastor
and psychologist.
They are father and son. Your hosts, Emerson and Jonathan Egerich.
Are you ready?
Here we go.
Welcome to the Love and Respect Podcast. I'm Jonathan Egerich, joined here by my father, Emerson Egerich. As always, we are so thankful that you're joining us, whether you've been with us since the beginning, all 100 and now 18 episodes, and maybe you're joining us for the first time today. We just want to say welcome and say hope you feel blessed by this episode, but feel blessed by the opportunity to go back and browse through all the topics that are there and available, and some, you know, collect together. So there'll be, you know, 10 podcasts on, you know, kind of the family theme, for instance. And then, you know, some may have significant overlap, and then, you know, 50, 60, 70 podcast episodes that pertain to marriage and that type of, and that relationship. And so again, feel free to browse around. You can do that at loveandrespectpodcast.com. You can do that via our app, which is available on all platforms. You can find all this material at loveandrespect.com, the blog there, lots of places to reference this. It's always announced on social media each week, but the probably most popular places to access the podcast would be at the podcast site, loveandrespectpodcast.com, and then downloading the app for your mobile phone, available for Android, Windows, and Apple devices. But did want to just highlight a product. We haven't done that in a while. My parents do this live marriage conference that they've done since, the early 2000s when the conference was launched, Dad?
Yeah, actually 1999, we launched the Love and Respect Marriage Conferences.
Yeah, sometimes I forget which came first, the conference or the book, and it was actually the conference, right?
Correct. Yeah, almost four years, because we wrote the book in 2003 and it came out in 2004. So almost, you know, 5 years before that book was out. But it's the book is the conference on paper. So we had done it enough that we kind of knew what buttons, you know, to push where people were really responding. And I think that's why the book has done so well, because we were able to minister to the hearts of people in that book and also the live conference.
Yeah. And so, you know, you did the live conference for years, the book came out, and then eventually there was a DVD series produced on that. And that has been available for the last 10 years. And actually on that note, there'll be a new version, not necessarily of the conference, but a new version of the small group study related to that, that will be either coming out late this fall or the beginning of next year. But did want to highlight that yes, the DVD is currently available, but easy access to those of you that have never looked at the conference is just the online streaming version, which you can find in our store at loveandrespect.com. And you'll get 6.5 hours of content broken down into five sessions. My dad doing about 5.5 hours of that speaking, and my mother doing about an hour of that speaking and teaching. And you can download a PDF version of the guide that people get when they're at the conference, fill in the blank, all the scripture references. And so if you've never, you know, maybe didn't even know that exists, but if you did know it exists, you've never accessed it, I mean, this is a powerful way of consuming the material. 6.5 hours of content filmed in front of a live audience, high quality, high definition video, instantly accessible upon your purchase in our store. I don't know if you wanted to say anything else just about the content. I just wanted to highlight that it's available.
No, it was a live audience, but some of them looked dead when I was talking to them. No, just kidding. But yeah, we're very excited about that conference. That's been kind of the base and foundation. And people who are newer, you know, we don't want to ever assume that you know what we're doing out here. It is a Friday night, Saturday morning that Mom, Sarah, and I have done over the years of couples coming. And it just has been a very meaningful ministry that we've had to couples. And if you're not aware of that, as Jonathan pointed out, please become familiar with it. And it is kind of the core of what we've been communicating.
Yeah. So thanks for paying attention for a couple minutes on that. And if you haven't had a chance to check out, you know, episode 117, episode, you know, 116, et cetera, again, I mentioned the place where you can go back and listen to those. I mean, last week we did episode 117, Submission and Mutual Submission. Yikes, you know, was the title. And I appreciate all of those of you who gave feedback and, you know, passed it on to those that you know. But without further ado today, we'll jump into today's episode, episode 118, titled The Four Seasons of Marriage. And I was actually, you know, curious about this one, Dad, because you said you were going back and just kind of reviewing some, you know, content from years ago, and you came across this and it kind of, you know, got you energized and exciting as you were doing some thinking. So I'm excited to explore this, and I hope the audience as well. So I'll turn it over to you now.
Well, actually, when we first were thinking about titles back in 98, 99, you know, well, should we be Love and Respect? And we kind of talked, maybe we should title it Me, Adam, You, Eve. And the idea that, you know, what happened to marital paradise? It's a jungle out there. But I don't think we got a second vote on that. But anyway, I've always played around with metaphors and different things. And part of that time of looking at all the scriptures and looking at couples in particular, I saw that there were these four seasons in a sense, that you could see people going from, you know, just exciting love relationships, and we're going to talk about that today, and then suddenly hitting a wall. And we don't pay attention sometimes to the history of these husbands and wives. And we want to do that because I realize, you know what, in a sense, there are four seasons of marriage. And I want us to take a look at that today because some of us, you know, in the initial stages, there's all this, you know, infatuation, love, excitement, romance. But then there comes another season and we try to make sense out of that season. And we thought, some of us think, you know, did I make a mistake here? Or, you know, why is this happening to us? And then if we go on Facebook today, we see everybody else is happy but us. And we begin to compare ourselves and we begin to draw some conclusions that really are not perhaps accurate, that people are all going through these seasons at one level or another. And we need to see that as normal and not be frightened by it and see it as really the key to deepening in the relationship. And so I want us to launch in today on two of the seasons, and then next week we'll conclude with the last two seasons. Does that make sense?
Good. Yeah, it does. It sounds good. I'm excited.
Why don't you start us, though? Why is marital paradise lost? That's the question that I'm asking here. And why do couples feel they have left Eden, if we could put it in those terms, and live in a jungle of sorts? And since Scripture indicates couples will have trouble in this life, 1 Corinthians 7:28, if you marry, you know, you have not sinned, but you will have trouble. There is that 1 Corinthians 7:28 verse that we've highlighted numerous times that, hey, there are going to be difficulties simply because we get married. And, how do we prepare for this? So the answer is simple. That people sometimes are unprepared because they're not prepared for these four seasons. And Jonathan, would you continue reading there as I have unfolded some of that?
In one way or another, all couples will go through the following four seasons. Those who go through them without defeat do so because they anticipate and accept the process. For example, skipping the fall chill and winter darkness is not possible. The sooner couples ready themselves, the smoother will be their sailing through the storms. By way of analogy, sailors prepare for the storms of sea before they set sail. When the storms come, they are prepared. Yes, the boat is rocked, but emotionally the sailors do not freak out. There are no major surprises. So when the wind blows and the waves roll the ship, the sailors wait out the storm. They know the dark clouds will clear and sun and stars will be seen again. Calm seas await them. And beyond that, the safe harbor will soon be entered.
Mm-hmm. And so the question is, are you prepared for the four seasons of marriage? And we're going to look at the first one, which is the perfect season. And we're going to conclude with that beautiful, beautiful last season, which is the kind of the joy of it all, what I call the spring gladness or the enjoyment season. The winter chill that he referenced and, the fall chill, the perplexity of things, we're going to be coming down through these. But if you think about it, I think this can greatly encourage you as you look at various couples and the process that they went through. And we want to begin with the first one, what I call the summer beauty or the perfect season. Would you read that introduction there? But do you have a comment first?
Yeah, as you referenced this, there's a part of me that's saying, hey, this is fantastic for, somebody like myself who's been married, for 10 or 11 years, just kind of, revisiting some things, preparing, for the future as well. But this is an episode that is highly applicable to those that are not married yet or pre-married and engaged.
Perfect. Yeah, exactly. This is something that couples need to anticipate as they get into a relationship, particularly because when we meet someone, we've been alone and we've been lonely, and now suddenly this person comes into our life. And it is a happy, highly energizing time. And the thought is, hey, this should continue. And we're not going to have the problems that anybody else has ever had. We're different. Found my soulmate. We're going to be happy campers, and I don't know why everybody talks about all these problems, but I feel sorry for them because we're going to make it through. Now, at the same time, my cynicism there can prove to be discouraging because then people think, well, should I just, accept the fact that I'm going to be unhappy? No. Well, there's a balance here. You don't want to get depressed, otherwise you would never get married in one sense, but you mustn't conclude that if you get married, you're going to be depressed either, because there's a lot of joy that God intends for us to have. There's a balance, though, and I don't know your frame of reference, but if you've got a 99% expectation of happiness, you're not going to experience that. That's too high of a standard, but neither should you have a 20 to 25% expectation. I kind of call it the 80-20 rule. And 80% of this can be a deep, meaningful friendship, but you're going to have 20% of the time where there are going to be some challenges. So if you're anticipating a relationship or you're in the front end of a relationship, please hear what we have to say here, because this will prepare you for the storm like the sailors prepare for the storm. So does that kind of capitalize on the point?
Yeah, it does. And I want to reference people back to, some of those episodes we did back to back on pre-marriage, type of stuff, where it's, how do you be a mature person? How do you find a mature person? Right. And then how do you have kind of a mature mission, together as well? And certainly those are, applicable to those that are not yet married, and yet people who are married, found meaning in it. And in the same way, this comes in and out of applicable to, pre-married, but married as well. Just, depends on where we're at. And if we need to go back and figure some things out or just strictly look forward based on, what you're going to reference here.
Mm-hmm. No, that's did you look that up, or did you recall the be mature, find a mature person, have a mature mission?
Things that you talk about stick with me.
Man, I'm impressed. Mm-hmm. I'm impressed.
Maybe it hit home because I was so immature.
And you married such a mature person the contrast was so obvious.
The juxtaposition was high.
But so let's begin with that summer first paragraph under summer beauty, the perfect season, Jonathan.
We love and respect one another. Nothing really troubles the relationship in a threatening way. We understand each other perfectly. At first, we are happy and highly energized because we are in love with the ideal person for us. At a distance, love believes all the good things about that person, and should. We feel we understand that person perfectly, and that person understands us perfectly. We give and provide because we love. We are soulmates. We protect. We feel close.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And God intends that. Obviously, if none of that's happening in the initial stages of relationship, I suppose I would suggest, I don't think this is probably working out too well. So, this should be present in a relationship, and it's healthy, and it's appropriate, and it's exciting. Given that there's some basic normalcy as to who we are as human beings, this is what God intends. And my question, and I'd have you read the verse, we're going to look at these various couples, Jacob and Rachel. And my question is, did Jacob have a love for Rachel that was so consuming that it caused time to fly? Jonathan, would you read that text?
Yeah. Genesis 29:20. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her.
That's a well-known verse that many have come across. He served 7 years. That was part of the condition that he had to fulfill to be able to marry her. But it seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her. That's the kind of love, that's the kind of experience that many have. It's like time flies. And mm-hmm. God intends for that in many levels. And it's a very powerful, powerful portrait of how God intends two people to come together and to have that kind of joy. But we're going to see in a moment that they went through another season. So keep Jacob and Rachel in mind. And because you're going to see that you can have that kind of love, but then you kind of hit some walls and some obstacles.
Yeah, I mean, related to that, right? You have 1 Corinthians 13:7, right? Which says, love bears all things and endures all things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's going to come. And they're going to be tested on that, whether they will bear the challenges that are before them and endure the situations that are before them. It's not an easy time for them. And they are going to find themselves, you know, with some real challenges.
But I think that references what Jacob was doing even there initially, right? I mean, he was in love, right? I mean, it was, I can do this because of how much I, right? I mean, I can love. I mean, there's the positive sense of what love can endure. And then there's, you know, kind of the, I guess the, you know, the negative, you know, view of it, you know, is as well, if that makes sense. Because that verse is in there in terms of what, why Jacob was able to do what he was doing, right? Because he was in love with Rachel.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, that's the point that we're making. It's this, you know, perfect season. I found the perfect person. And life is wonderful. It's the summer beauty. Mm-hmm. But we're going to see in a moment, as I pointed out, a change, though. But here's another question. Did the Shulamite, and this is in the Song of Solomon, this is the woman, the Shulamite, that's what we know about her. Did the Shulamite have a relationship with Solomon, that's who she was in love with, that characterized and can be characterized as kind of a soul love? Read those verses, if you would.
It says, "You whom my soul loves, whom my soul loves, whom my soul loves, whom,
and
whom
my soul..." What I did is I took the refrain. Exactly. I took the refrain. It's 1 Corinthians, or excuse me, Solomon 1:7.
Kept repeating it.
Yeah, 3. Well, it's because in Solomon 1:7 it said, I should have not set you up for that trap. And then the third chapter, verses 1-4, you see this ongoing refrain, whom my soul loves. And that's what you captured, and it felt foolish saying it so many times, but you see it again and again and again as this is unpacked there. And then she says, I held on to him and would not let him go. And so here again, you see this deep love, and it is expressed as that soulmate. Some of that perhaps comes out of the Song of Solomon, because you see this romance between the two of them. But we're going to find that they too hit a wall later on, not to depress us, but to encourage those who have these Rachel and Jacob and the Shulamite and Solomon experiences, and then there is another season that, well, what happened to that? And you begin to think, you know, is there something abnormal to us? Well, not if I'm reading the scripture correctly or the research correctly. This is part of the process. Here's another question. Did Michael, who is a female that married King David, did Michael and David put themselves in harm's way because of their sacrificial love? And read those verses if you would. And again, hopefully I haven't set you up to look foolish.
No, it repeats itself again. But now Michael, Saul's daughter, loved David. Then later on, Michael, Saul's daughter, loved him. Michael let David down through a window, and he went out and fled and escaped. And that's from 1 Samuel.
Yeah, and on that point, there was a troubling moment, and that verse is indicating that she put herself in harm's way to get him out of harm's way. And that was a dangerous thing for her to do, but she helped him escape. So in answer to the first question, Michael was in love with this man beyond anything that perhaps can be measured, and she was even willing, in a sense, to die for him in her attempt to get him out of a violent situation. But what about David toward Michael? 1 Samuel 18:27.
Yeah, the verses that you still talk about as an adult that made you sheepish and giggle when you were 8 years old, right? Here I get to read it, right? David struck down 200 men among the Philistines. Then David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. So Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, for a wife.
Mm-hmm. And the violence is not the point here. This is war, and it's ugly. It's not good. And yet there was this condition that if he did these things, in this time of war, and that he would be awarded the daughter. This was Saul, the king at that time, and Michal was his daughter. And again, David put himself in harm's way in order to win this woman. And I think as I just came across this, I realized, whoa, you know, these two individuals were deeply in love. They definitely were. But we're going to see another season where things began to turn a different direction. Mm-hmm. And we all know Adam and Eve, but did Adam and Eve have a relationship that was perfect? Well, obviously, we would say for a period of time, they did. They were the only perfect couple. They were born in paradise. We believe that. Jesus said, have you not read, he who made them from the beginning, referring to Adam and Eve. And so there is this couple, and they are perfect. And we all know that verse, and the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. And they were not ashamed because they were in a sinless state. But did it continue? Did that relationship in the Hebrew, when Adam saw Eve, it's kind of like, you know, where you been all my life, woman? I mean, he was pumped. He was excited when he saw her. I mean, the intensity, the emotion at that moment is incredible. But we all kind of know where that story is going to go. And we've all suffered the consequences of that because of it. Here's another couple, Elkanah. Has a depth of love for Hannah that was full of giving and benevolence. True or false? Read 1 Samuel 1:5.
But to Hannah he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, but the Lord had closed her womb.
Mm-hmm. And many of us know the story of Hannah, where she pleads with God to have a baby, and that's a very moving account and story. Yet we don't always pay attention to the depth of love that he had for Hannah and what he felt and how he gave to her in double portion and the deep, deep love. And yet, looming on the horizon is another season. Do you have any comments, Jonathan, about this first season, this season of the perfect season, the summer beauty, I call it?
No, but I mean, I think I'd love for you to just kind of summarize again this summer beauty, this perfect season, but this expectation that, you know, should be there, that this is a good thing. This should be there when you meet somebody or when you're pursuing somebody. I mean, I think that's what I'm hearing you say, and it should be enjoyed.
Correct. And yet we all know that there's a fine line between superficial infatuation, you know, and, you know, we begin to become acquainted with an individual. We have common interest. We bring a basic maturity. We kind of know their heart for God. We've observed them as they interact with other people. And, you know, if we bring a degree of maturity to this, rather than, you know, I love you, hello, what's your name? You know, I mean, one of the Beatles song, I believe it is, or some song from the 60s. And, you know, how superficial that we, you know, I mean, it's been said, you know, love at first sight is one of life's great time savers. You know, I mean, what a way to hurry things along. So on the one hand, we're not talking about this immature infatuation and without any substance at all. So I'm assuming some degree of substance here in the relationship, and that it is A-okay, to your point, to have a great deal of excitement about this. There's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, I take the position that there should be some degree of chemistry and excitement and thrill. Otherwise, you know, what's going on? Now, having said that, around the world, there are some marriages that are assigned. And I always am very respectful of that, because I take the position that two people who have an assigned marriage, whether in India or even in the Old Testament, you see this, and even in the New Testament, it's hinted at, that you can still learn to love and respect each other. And in fact, sometimes those relationships can be far more mature because it's not rooted in that infatuation. And they come into the situation knowing that they've got to learn how to get along and how to really love and respect each other. And sometimes that maturity allows them to have a deeper relationship than the couple that is, you know, all over each other.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's look at that second season, what I call the fall chill, the perplexity season.
So in terms of just the outline, we're doing summer beauty and then the fall chill. Those are the two that we're doing today?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Okay, fall chill, the perplexity season. This is where we question our love and respect for one another. Trouble begins to test the relationship, and we wonder about our love and respect. One might ask, why don't you understand me? There comes a moment of frustration and confusion because of significant distress. During that significant conflict, we expect to be understood but feel misunderstood. Further, they expect us to understand, but we do not understand. Both feel chilled that expectations are unmet. This wasn't supposed to happen. Tension enters. Sin enters. It seems forces come at us from the outside world and from inside of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So now let's come back to Jacob and Rachel. Did Jacob and Rachel's love become frustrated by a conflict over barrenness? And did she expect him to do something, and he expected her to understand that he could not do what she expected? And did both expect the other to understand? Read Genesis 30, verses 1 and 2.
Now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, and she said to Jacob, "Give me children or else I die." Then Jacob's anger burned against Rachel, and he said, "Am I in the place of God, who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?"
Wow. Is this the couple, Jonathan, that he worked 7 years like it was only a few days?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is going on? I mean, what is going on? And should we be surprised by this? I mean, we herald, you know, Rachel and Jacob's relationship. Oh, this is the way. But we don't keep reading. You know, one of the things that I always say about Scripture, just keep reading. A lot of times the answers come. Just keep reading. But here she is frustrated and our hearts go out to her. She's barren. But what she does is she's very demanding and coercive and threatening. She's threatening suicide. Now, we can be dismissive and say, don't take those words at face value. But she says, give me children. It's a command. She's coercive. She's in control here. Or else I die. You know, wow. Why is she saying to this, the guy that worked 7 years for her was in love with her? I mean, what's going on? And so then Jacob's, it says, his anger burned against Rachel. Wow. He is not happy. And then he says, am I in the place of God? He gets sarcastic. Who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? So he's not empathetic. He should have decoded. He doesn't decode. Instead, he gets angry like most men get angry when the wife is making a demand that he thinks is unrealistic. She's, you know, just venting because she's in pain. He completely misses that. But, you know, you talk about a couple that's going to get on the crazy cycle, they're full bore on that. So here you have this chilling moment between these two individuals. And the question is the Lord shocked by this? And should we all be shocked by this? Or is this part of life? Because now, you know, they're confronted with the fact that she's barren. And how are they going to deal with this unanticipated sadness of her womanly heart?
Mm-hmm.
Next question. Did Solomon and the Shulamite in their relationship get eaten by little foxes? That is, did little things begin to eat away at their perfect love? And did they fail to guard their hearts against jealousy? There are several verses here.
Yeah, so this is a reminder, right, where I was repeating myself, and this is the one she said over and over again, whom I love, whom I love, whom I love,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And so Solomon, Song of Solomon 2:15, catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that are ruining the vineyards while our vineyards are in blossom. Mm. And Song of Solomon 8:6-7, put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death. Jealousy is as severe as Sheol. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, they had enough wisdom to know that there are little things, the little foxes. It's a metaphor that little things, not the big things, can destroy a relationship. And certainly there can be jealousy, which is one of the points. So there's the recognition that there could be a potential problem in their relationship. It's now no longer this, oh, the man that I love, the soul, we're the soulmates. It's kind of like, you know what, we kind of got to be guarded here a little bit. There are some things that could undermine our relationship. And let me say, by way of sidebar, we know that when Solomon was older, his heart was turned away from the Lord, the wisest man. God appeared to Solomon twice, and it was because of foreign women. And so we don't really know what happened to the Shulamite, but she did not remain the object of his affection. And that's very depressing. It's very depressing that this would happen. And one of the reasons that I believe the scripture is so true, it never seeks to protect its main characters. It's not trying to, that the Jews did not soften the descriptions of people whose hearts turn wayward, not the least of which is Solomon. And here you see this couple not making it to the end. And I have to say that's true in this situation, as painful it is for me to say that. They went through a season where this relationship ceased to be. But even here, they're beginning to sense, you know what? We've got to guard ourselves. And they didn't do a good job of it. And this is where I think Paul said, take heed, he who thinks he stands, lest he falls. Those of you in a relationship, never assume that everything is safe and sound and secure. In some ways, you know, we must arise every day with the thought that we could go under, and then we take steps to prevent that, not to be fearful, but to be prudent. And certainly, we need to be warned, because they themselves didn't heed even the little insights they had about the potential dangers to their relationship. They presumed. They were assuming. They were presumptuous. And we need to be those who say, you know what, I need to learn from them. What about Michael and David? Here, this couple, you know, the daughter of Saul. Though Michael had loved David deeply, did she become ashamed of his conduct during a time where David was worshiping? And did she even despise him in her heart? And did that relationship continue? I think this would be something for you to read. It's very powerful.
2 Samuel 6, 16 and 20 through 23. Then it happened, as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, that Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. Michal came out to meet David and said, "How the king of Israel distinguished himself today. He uncovered himself in the eyes of his servants' maids as one of the foolish ones shamelessly uncovers himself." So David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house, to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord, over Israel. Therefore I will celebrate before the Lord, and I will be more lightly esteemed than this, and will be humble in my own eyes. But with the maids of whom you have spoken, with them I will be distinguished."
Yeah, this is one of those verses I use, that she did not respect him. She did not esteem him. She was putting him down. He was worshiping, but because he didn't do it in a way that she found acceptable, that marriage ended. She did not have any children. She was barren. And this was a very, very troubling moment. Here they both were willing to give their lives for each other that we referenced earlier in that perfect season, the summer beauty. And now they're in this chilling moment where she's criticizing the way he worships and he did not receive it. And for all practical purposes, that relationship ended. I don't justify that. I'm describing it, not prescribing it. But here again, you see this chilling moment. And were they prepared to deal with it? Was that God's ultimate will that they end a relationship? No. But they had this moment of conflict, and they did not resolve that conflict in the way that I believe the Lord wanted them to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Did Adam and Eve love, did their love become frustrated by a sinful desire over wanting more and by listening to voices other than God's? You know, whereas Adam told Eve what God said about not eating from the tree, does she decide to listen to a voice contrary to God's voice? Is she dissatisfied with paradise? One of the points I make is Eve had paradise but wanted more. Some refer to it as the insatiability of the female, never satisfied. I always thought that's intriguing, not to put women down, but I think in some ways there is this desire for wisdom, and for it's an idealism that can get you carried away in the wrong direction. It's not a sinful, evil kind of thing. It's wanting more of God, more of wisdom, more of the delights of that maybe are not to be expected here on the planet. But and does she expect Adam to listen to her and join her efforts to get more? And does Adam listen to his wife's voice? Does Adam become spiritually passive? And instead of listening to God's voice and expecting his wife to listen to God's voice and word, Adam listens to the voice of his wife. And are we all then perplexed over this pattern in them and in us? And I think we can see this tendency. The man becomes more and more passive. And as I've pointed out before in other things, women don't criticize male dominance. They criticize the fact that my husband's not the spiritual leader, that he's passive. And the men just feel like the women control, and goes back even to the garden. But read Genesis 3, and very sobering.
Verses 1 and 6. Now the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, "Indeed, has God said, you shall not eat from any tree of the garden?" When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from its fruit and ate, and she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. Then Genesis 3:17. Then to Adam he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife," and then right, the Lord.
Yeah, and that's when the consequence of sin came in. The fall of humanity, Adam and Eve, you know, and that's when sin entered the world and all the implication of that. And that's why Christ came and died for our sin, because this set in motion, you know, what theologians have been studying for centuries as to the implication of the sin that entered the world through one man, Adam. And but then Christ, the new Adam, came to die for that sin, and Romans unpacks the wisdom and the beauty of that. But here you see the perfect couple falling, and the dynamics between husband and wife that get played out between all of us. The challenge for us men is to be the humble, godly, spiritual leader and not give in just because, you know, it's easier. But that doesn't mean that we are stubborn or angry or mean-spirited. You submit to me, woman. That's not the point. But in humility and in holiness, maintaining that demeanor. But Adam rolled over, and Eve was listening to voices about having more. And it wasn't an evil that she was being tempted to have. It was good. Many women today have this idealism within them, and they want more. They want more. And it's a pure thing at some level. The romance novels indicate this. Not pornography, but it's romance about the ideal love. I want more. I want more. The insatiability. And these are things that come into the relationship and can be the seeds, the little foxes that begin to undermine that. We've got to get a perspective on this and maintain a godly perspective. Otherwise, we're going to give in to some of these things, a passivity or an insatiability. And these can be the undoing of the relationship. And let's take a look at our last couple. Remember Hannah and Elkanah? And read what happened there, Jonathan. 1 Samuel 1:8.
Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Hannah, why do you weep, and why do you not eat, and why is your heart sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?" And in verse 1:15, Hannah said, "I am a woman oppressed in spirit. I have poured out my soul before the Lord."
Mm-hmm. And again, she is barren, and she's now oppressed in spirit because she's barren. And that kind of thing happens. We know that when a woman cannot have a baby, how painful and difficult that is, because she has all this love in her to give, but not having a baby to love like this. I mean, this is torturous, nothing short of emotionally torturous to women. But I always chuckle at her husband. Hey, Hannah, I know you're oppressed in spirit. I know you're depressed. I don't know why you're so sad. I mean, hey, look at me. Am I not better to you than 10 sons? The wonderful male solution. I always chuckle at this guy. Hey, come on. You got a real gift in me. This should be sufficient, you know. And of course, that statement was made before she said, "I'm a woman oppressed in spirit." So clearly it had no impact. But I think the broader point here is, again, there are come moments when we don't have the power to heal our wives, gentlemen. There are things that are going to be beyond us. We are impotent at some level. And how are we going to deal with that? It can become very painful to us. And as wives, there are situations that are beyond our control, like in the case of barrenness. So here you see this chilling season where these couples that we referenced earlier are madly in love, and now in some ways they're just mad. And this is something that we need to learn from. Paul says these things in the Old Testament were written for our instruction. and we need to become the wiser for it. We do not have to make the same mistakes. At the same time, we need to ask, hey, are we going to have the second season on the heels of that first season? The summer beauty moves to this chilling, you know, winter and fall, and it is a very, very difficult time for us. And but you're perhaps right on course, so just relax. But as we bring this to a close, Jonathan, what are some comments or questions that you might have?
No, I find this very interesting, and I hope the audience does as well. You know, as we were talking beforehand, you know, you've written on this long ago, and I had, you know, briefly, you know, read some of it. But I like how these five examples, you're able to trace these five couples or five relationships through the four different seasons, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think I appreciate that perspective. And I hope that, you know, couples who are not yet married, right, are getting the sense of, okay, I should be planning and preparing for some of this, but also people who are married, right, recognizing, yep, we've been through all four of those, right? Or we're in, you know, a fall, you know, right now, or as we're going to talk about, the winter darkness and the summer gladness in next time's episode, right? And so I like how we're going to, you know, seasonal, we're going to come full circle, or that we should expect, you know, and we've always kind of, you know, life is cyclical. We come in and out of these things, and there can be the wonders and there can be the darkness and the sadness. And that's a part of this life. And we should, you know, rejoice on the one hand and persevere on the other. And so I'm excited to see how you wrap this up next time.
Yeah, we'll continue with those couples. And it is fascinating. And you caught that. And that's why it was exciting for me to look at the scriptures, like, whoa, I see a pattern here. And there are these things that happen with all couples. And hopefully that encourages those of you who are listening. And you have a sense of anticipation that it's going to end in not winter darkness. We're going to continue the next time, the cheerless season. So it's still going to get a little bit more depressing, maybe, which is not an exciting thing. But we're going to wrap it up with the spring gladness, the enjoyment season. And what is it that God ultimately is seeking to do in the lives of husbands and wives?
Yeah, I misspoke. I said summer gladness, but yeah, spring gladness. So we are so glad that you could join us this week, as we alluded to in the beginning, or all the places where you can check out the podcast, how you can share it with others, those types of things, alluded to the product that you can check out, but lots of other things in our store as well. Thanks as always for joining us. Thanks as always for sharing the message with others. And thanks as always for those of you that leaves reviews or comments. They are deeply meaningful to us in iTunes and other places. Take care.
You've been listening to the Love and Respect Podcast. For more information and additional products, go to loveandrespect.com and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join Emerson and Jonathan next week for another episode.